Colectivo Raíces presenta su programa
Espejos de Aztlán.
Información,
arte,
cultura.
Bienvenidos.
Good evening and welcome to Espejos de Aztlán. For over 10 years, five Cuban men have been incarcerated in federal prisons throughout the United States. They were arrested in South Florida in 1998 and later convicted in Miami of multiple charges, including conspiracy to commit espionage and aiding and abetting murder, the latter in reference to alleged complicity in the Cuban shootdown of Florida-based planes engaging in overflights of Cuban airspace in the 1990s. Antonio Guerrero, Fernando González, Gerardo Hernández, Ramón Lavaniño, and René González presently await a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to hear their appeal, which focuses on their claim that it was impossible to receive a fair trial in Miami for 50 years a center of right-wing Cuban exile power. Saul Landau is a filmmaker, journalist, and author. He has been awarded for his work, including an Emmy for Paul Jacobs and the Nuclear Gang in 1980, and the Edgar Allan Poe Award, also in 1980, for Assassination on Embassy Row, which he wrote with John Dinges about the murder of former Chilean diplomat Orlando Letelier. Landau is also recipient of the Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Award, presented by the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies, for his life's contribution to human rights. Landau was in Albuquerque this past weekend, where he joined Cuban-American sociologist Nelson Valdez in a presentation at the University of New Mexico on the Cuban Five, U.S.-based terrorism directed at Cuba, and the legacy of the Cuban Revolution, which turned 50 on January 1st of this year. Espejos de Aztlán had the opportunity to speak with Saul Landau about these subjects. We pick up the interview focusing on his forthcoming film, Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up?, which will chronicle the case of the Five, one little known to the North American public, but which has attracted growing international attention.
I'm making this film with Jack Willis, who I teamed up with way back 1978, 79, and we made Paul Jacobs and the Nuclear Gang together, which won us an Emmy. And then in 1988, we teamed up again and made The Uncompromising Revolution with Fidel Castro, which was a public television show. We're making the film to tell people about the Cuban Five, and the title, Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up?, has to do with the definition of terrorism. The United States government, which has declared itself at war with terrorism, is on its own soil really coddling terrorists, if not downright encouraging them, as long as these terrorists direct their violent actions against Cuba. And that, of course, is the reason for the Cuban Five. The Cubans were the victims of terrorism, not just from 1959, 60, 61, and on, but in recent years when they began to cultivate tourism as their economy sank into the toilet. They had to go somewhere, and they went with tourism. And the anti-revolutionary or anti-Castro exiles in Miami decided that they would put an end to tourism in Cuba by blowing up hotels, restaurants, bars, and other spots where tourists would go. And I would say that this would put a dent in one's tourist plans if one saw that the hotel you were planning to stay at has just been bombed. So the Cubans, since the FBI wasn't doing anything, stopped these people from sending explosives into Cuba and then detonating them. The Cubans sent their own people in to infiltrate the very groups that were doing the violent acts and plotting to do violent acts. These groups were called Brothers to the Rescue, that were doing overflights of Cuba, and God knows what they were planning to drop. Alpha 66, which was dedicated to violence and the violent overthrow of the Cuban government, Commandos F, these are the kinds of groups that they infiltrated. These people were, of course, Cuban spies. They were agents of Cuban state security. But they were not interested in finding out secrets of the United States government. So their spying was for the exclusive purpose of preventing damage to Cuba. And ironically, they were taking the information that they found out and sharing it with the United States government. They would send it to Havana, and Havana would then retransmit it to the Department of Justice, to the FBI, telling them where there were being shipments of explosives coming down the Miami River, where there would be large arms caches, and where they could find them. And the FBI, at first, took advantage of this information and did grab a couple highly dangerous explosive caches and arms caches. But then, surprisingly, the FBI turned on its very sources of valuable information on terrorism and arrested them. At first, they were charged with really relatively minor offenses. And, I mean, they were guilty, prima facie, of having not registered under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Maximum penalty, by the way, for that is 18 months. But they weren't just charged with that. Some months after they were arrested, they were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage and aiding and abetting murder. And these got them, at the trial, consecutive life sentences and other long sentences for the rest. The trial was held in Miami, or as we like to call it, the Independent and Autonomous Republic of Miami, where rules for fair trials are a bit different than they are in the rest of the country. At the trial, the government made a pitiful, ridiculous case. And almost all lawyers who watched it, whether they liked Fidel or the revolution or not, agreed. The government presented almost no evidence, but the jury didn't dare to acquit these men, fearing, of course, and logically so, that if they did so, their houses would get firebombed or worse. And so the jury, in a record time, despite the total lack of evidence presented by the prosecution, convicted these five Cubans on all counts. Then the judge, equally frightened, sentenced them to the max. And that's basically what the trial is. Since then, there have been appeal after appeal, and the case is going to the Supreme Court on the change of venue argument that they couldn't possibly have gotten a fair trial.
Which they won a decision on in Atlanta a few years ago. What happened with that?
A three-judge panel in Atlanta had ruled that, indeed, the case on venue was a strong one. The larger court en banc, the 11 members of the appeals court in Atlanta, then ruled for the prosecution. So it went back and it was re-argued, and now it's been kicked back up and is going to the Supreme Court, which will hopefully decide that the venue issue was a valid one, and either they be freed or given a new trial.
Sal, you referred to the Autonomous Republic of Miami. Tell our listeners a little bit more about what you mean when you say that.
Well, in 1959, when the Cuban Revolution took place, when it actually took power in January of that year, the large exodus of anti-revolutionary Cubans began. And these were headed, of course, by immediately the very rich and very powerful pro-Batista, who was the dictator that was overthrown, group. And within a couple of years, they began to establish a power base, not just an economic power base. After all, they had stolen an awful lot of money when they left Cuba just on the eve of the revolution. Some of the generals had taken it. And they put this money to good use for themselves and their families. And they established an economic and a political power base from which they then began to assert a variety of domination, and especially all institutions that involved in any way, shape, or form dealings with Cuba. For example, a textbook that would show a smiling child in a Cuban school was taken out of the schools because this group of people decided that no Miami child should ever see a smiling Cuban child living under this communist totalitarian government. This is the kind of activity that they undertook. When the Miami Herald, the leading newspaper of Miami, dared to take issue with the leading group, at that time it was called the Cuban American National Foundation, a major campaign was undertaken. The Herald doesn't tell the truth. The Herald's newspaper boxes where it sells the paper on the street were smeared with excrement. The buses were painted, "Don't trust the Herald." Death threats were telephoned in to Herald editors and to the publisher. And shockingly enough, the Herald conceded and gave in and said, okay, we can't take this anymore. So this is the kind of activity that I refer to when I talk about the Autonomous Republic of Miami. If you have a base of now almost 1 million Cubans maybe living in the Miami area who support, a large percentage of whom support you either because they believe in what you're saying or because they're intimidated. And believe me, these guys know how to intimidate. Those people who have disagreed have been blown up. Emilio Millán was blown up in his car for suggesting that maybe dialogue would be a better idea. Lost both of his legs. Max Lesnik, who was a radio commentator and a magazine publisher, had bomb threats. His office was bombed. Francisco Arruca, who was a travel agent, who was running tours and charter flights to Cuba from Miami, his life was threatened innumerable times. He also was a radio commentator. And these examples go on and on. You have footage of Cubans training with heavy arms in the Everglades, claiming they are training to go to invade Cuba. And the United States government doesn't touch them, even though these arms are illegal. And their intention is illegal. Anyway, this is the kind of factor. So you can't have a free, fair trial when the issue involves Cuba. And you can't have free speech when the issue involves Cuba. I mean, you can't publish anything you want in Cuba, and it doesn't have total free speech. But I could stand up in a Cuban bus or in the Cuban square and say, I think Fidel Castro is a no-good SOB. Somebody would say, oh, you jerk, or something like that. If I stood up in a crowded square in Miami and said, long live Fidel and the revolution, I'd be shot dead or strangled or beaten to death in 30 seconds.
I want to return to the theme of terrorism emanating from the United States towards Cuba and within Cuba. And I want to tell our listeners that we are speaking with Saul Landau, who is the producer of the forthcoming film, Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up? And we're talking about issues related to the five Cuban prisoners in the United States. And also I want to point out to our listeners, Sal, that I think the first time I ever came across your name was when you wrote Assassination on Embassy Row with other authors back in the late 70s, which dealt with a very similar situation of Cuban exiles being involved in the successful attempt on the life of the former UN ambassador from Chile and his associate at the Institute for Policy Studies, with which you've been affiliated for a long time as well. First of all, I wanted to ask you to give more of a sense of how the Cubans have been affected on the island by these kinds of activities, and also how is it that these actions, whether they come from Miami or New Jersey or wherever, are tolerated and allowed to take place by the United States government?
Well, the book I wrote, Assassination on Embassy Row, was co-authored with John Dengas. John, at the time, was the Washington Post stringer in Santiago, Chile. And Orlando Letelier, who had been the Chilean ambassador to the United States, and when he was arrested, the Minister of Defense, he was arrested on the day of the coup, on September 11th, strange date, of 1973. Then he came to the Institute for Policy Studies, where he worked with me until he was blown up. The person who actually put his hand on the button and pressed that button was a man named Virgilio or Virgil Paz, who had been a member of the Cuban nationalist movement located in northern New Jersey, Union City. And this was a ideologically fascist group, but ideology really didn't play much of a role in the life of these guys. You know, the FBI, with whom I actually worked, sometimes cooperatively and sometimes antagonistically during the years of the investigation, told me one true thing as I was analyzing the ideology of the various suspects during the pursuit of the killers, the FBI agent said to me, "Look, don't give me that ideological crap. Killers kill. They don't care what the ideology is." And I went, it was like a light bulb going off in my head, or, you know, the proverbial fish who swims into the concrete wall and says, "Damn, okay, obviously." Virgilio Paz was a killer. And his associate, Jose Dionisio Suarez and Guillermo Novo, these guys are killers. And they have an ideological facade. And this facade is very useful because it allows the political powers to intimidate an entire population. These guys are good intimidators. When they look at you and tell you, you got a nice store here, you know you're going to pay them money because bad things are going to happen to you. I mean, these are the real-life Tony Sopranos. And that's who they are. They're killers. And these are the people that the Cubans have had to deal with. When Luis Posada Carriles and Orlando Bosch conspire successfully in Venezuela, two Cuban exiles, to blow up a commercial airliner and kill all 73 passengers and crew members on board, and then they call it an act of war or an act of liberation, or, you know, I don't care what verbal garbage they throw at you, this is an act of mass murder. This is an act of international terrorism. Both of these people are walking freely on the streets of Miami. Well, Bosch isn't walking anymore. He had a stroke. But neither of them have been really bothered by the U.S. government. Now, if these guys had been Arabs or Muslims, my God, all they would have had to do is say a hint of what they were thinking of doing, and they'd be in Guantanamo with electric prods and water, torture, and so on. So the United States government is very selective about its war against terrorism. It means only those particular terrorists that it doesn't like because it thinks they might have negative ideas toward the United States. It has done nothing but cultivate and cooperate with the terrorists who have been attacking Cuba. And this is the irony, or double standard, or I don't know what you call it, two-faced policy that the United States has had that has made it, by the way, lose credibility throughout the world when it talks about fighting a war on terrorism and allows Luis Posada to get away and charged with an immigration violation when there is ample cable traffic that has been declassified that absolutely nails him as the man who did the airplane along with Orlando Bosch.
This is in reference to the downing of a Cubana Airlines flight in 1976 that was departing Barbados, that carried on it, amongst other people, a number of young members of the Cuban fencing team. You've been traveling to Cuba since 1961 and doing work there, and I wanted to get a sense from you of what kind of impact have those kinds of acts had, both on the Cuban economy in concrete terms, but also on the psyche of the population in Cuba?
Well, I mean, as all Americans now know from 9/11, terrorism terrorizes. When somebody does something so horrendous and outrageous as to blow up an airplane, whether you're on board or whether you just direct an agent to blow it up or leave an explosive on it, it is so horrendous that it leaves you trembling for a long time. It leaves you very frightened and insecure. Aside from the actual loss of life, all these people had relatives. The passengers, most of them Cuban, and the crew members all had relatives. And it makes people now begin to wonder, hey, who's next? If they dared to do such an outrageous act of terrorism against a commercial airline and they got away with it, my God, what will they do next? This is at least what would be on my mind. And when I talked to Cuban friends, this was on their minds. So any government of sane people has to deal with this situation. You can't allow this stuff to happen. And here the United States is harboring. Now, George Bush said it. He said, "He who harbors a terrorist is as guilty as the terrorist." He said that. But he, well, maybe I got to give him some. Maybe he didn't know what the word harbor meant. I mean, otherwise, it's an outrageous statement. It would have meant that he would have to call up the attorney general and said, I want Luis Posada and Orlando Bosch and all those other hoodlums down there who are carrying out acts of terrorism. I want you to lock them up, put them on trial, and throw the book at them. That didn't happen. And I'm not sure it will happen under this administration. After all, the United States government carried out thousands of terrorist acts against Cuba. This is documented. This is in declassified cables and reports. Between 1959 and 1963, over 3,000 terrorist acts were carried out. When I say terrorists, I mean the CIA launches a group of Cuban exiles, gives them heavy machine guns, cannons, explosives. They go to the Cuban shore, they shoot people, they kill them, they hit buildings, property. They'll try to destroy a refinery, a sugar mill. They'll try to burn a sugar cane field. This is what was happening 2, 3, 5 times a day. And it never really stopped. Now, the CIA hired these people to do this job. It paid them. It gave them the boats. It gave them the explosives and the guns. Then isn't it logical that the CIA doesn't just turn on these people and say, okay, now we're going to arrest you, or its counterpart, the FBI? And that's what happened. There's a Spanish saying that if you cultivate crows, they come back and pluck your eyes out. Every one of them should be in prison. Not one of them is in prison. The murder of Letelier and the murder of Ronnie Moffitt, it was a cold-blooded act. And the act was ordered, and the Justice Department knew it. It was ordered by Augusto Pinochet, the president dictator of Chile. His name was on the indictment, and the U.S. attorney in Washington never signed the paper. So the United States government, now carrying out a war on terrorism, fights only certain terrorists. So that's why we ask in the movie, will the real terrorist please stand up so we can identify him? Because the U.S. government criteria is the terrorist has to be pretty much a Muslim or an Arab to qualify for the definition. He doesn't have to bomb or kill people, but he has to have those other leanings or tendencies.
You are listening to Espejos de Aztlán, and we're very happy to have with us this evening Saul Landau, author and filmmaker, and someone who has had a very close relationship with Cuba and the Cuban people for almost as long as the revolution has been in existence. And we've been talking about the situation of U.S.-directed terrorism or base terrorism directed at Cuba, and the case of the 5 Cuban prisoners incarcerated in the United States. And Saul, you began to talk about how their case is now headed to the Supreme Court. Could you talk a little bit about the potential outcomes of this, depending on what the decision is and what the possibilities are for these 5 guys?
Well, being an eternal optimist, I would hope for the future that Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia and Justice Alito resign, and they are replaced by sane, careful, thoughtful, and more liberal judges. The case would then, I think, be decided to acquit the Cuban Five. However, the optimist in me is also qualified by the pessimist. Or I don't know, somebody said that we've reached the age in the world where the optimists and the pessimists finally agree, where the optimist says, look, this is the best of all possible worlds. And the pessimist says, I'm afraid you're right. Well, we'll see. I don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do. One can't really predict in this climate. Way back 100 plus years ago, Mr. Dooley said, the Supreme Court follows the election returns. And let's hope that that's true for this particular court. Certainly for those poor 5 guys who have spent now more than 10 years in prison, much of it in solitary, in conditions that are really quite horrible. And people should know about this case because symbolically, they're suffering. They're getting the punishment that the State Department and the national security apparatus has intended to give to Fidel Castro over the last 50 years. But Fidel's escaped all this punishment. And so sort of metaphorically or symbolically, these 5 guys are taking it for him. So, I mean, that's why the film is about 50 years of U.S.-Cuba relations, so that we understand. And, you know, one of the questions we have to ask is, what did Cuba do to the United States to merit 50 years, five decades of punishment? And I think if people will try to answer that question, we might have an interesting discussion. And hopefully the film will open that discussion up. One of the people we interview is somebody I would call a retired terrorist, Antonio Veciana, who the CIA counted on to assassinate Castro. Of course, he didn't do it, as we know. And Veciana tells us in the camera about several assassination attempts that he undertook and why they failed. And he also admits for the first time that he ordered the burning down of Cuba's great department store, the Encanto, the equivalent of Macy's in the United States. It was the department store of Latin America. So these are the kinds of interviews we've already done. I have to admit that we're looking for the final financing for this film, but hopefully we will get it and we will complete it, and before the year is out, people will see it on the big screen or on television or both.
We have a few minutes left, and I want to take off from what you just said regarding the past 50 years of the Cuban Revolution by reflecting on something you said earlier this afternoon at the University of New Mexico in your presentation with Nelson Valdez. You found it rare that a group of people have been able to write a script about the future of their country. I might not be getting it quite right, but what do you see as some of the main points of the legacy of the Cuban Revolution now in its 50th year?
Well, if you use my metaphor of a three-act play and just take acts one and two and cut them off there, you could say that the Cuban Revolution has been a real success. They succeeded in overthrowing a U.S.-backed dictatorship, military dictatorship, and replacing it with a government that made a population healthy and educated, and it spread ideas of social justice around. It added to that sovereignty and independence, and Cubans played a major role in the world, very unusual for a small third world country without major resources. Cubans have etched their names, engraved them as heroes in Pakistan, where they helped people after an earthquake, in Honduras, where they helped people after a terrible storm. All around the world, Cuban doctors have saved people's eyesight and allowed mothers to give birth to babies without problems. Cuban scientists have achieved recognition for developments in biomedicine and bioagriculture and surgery. Cuban artists, filmmakers, athletes. What third world country can match this? And finally, the Cuban military, in its role in Africa, helped secure the independence of South Africa, Namibia, and Angola. Now, these are great achievements for a people. It can make people proud. Having said all of that, what's the future script? And the answer is, I don't think anybody knows yet, and it hasn't been written.
Sal Landau, it's been a pleasure having you with us here on Espejos de Aztlán here on KUNM, and we hope to see you back again sometime soon in New Mexico.
Thank you.
Regresaré y le diré a la vida, he vuelto para ser tu confidente. De norte a sur le entregaré a la gente la parte del amor en mí escondida. Regaré la alegría desmedida de quien sabe reír humildemente. De este a oeste levantaré la frente con la bondad de siempre.